Hello and welcome back to the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton back again for this week, couple days later than usual. Busy week, but the culprit, blame Mark. You can choose which one you want. That's most convenient, but it's all good. But, better late than never. And we had to do this show, Mark. There was no question of skipping a show under any circumstances, just the way that we operate, but especially this week, because we've got there's lots of news, but we now basically have all the cars released, and we're going to rank all the cars and just starting in a minute. But before we do, I just want to do some shout outs. We've received a lot of emails and tweets this week, so I just want to, via email, we had messages from Devin Rance, John Guest, Ricardo Borges, and Shauna Campbell. All great to hear from you guys. Devin, new hardcore fan, he binged all the episodes from the beginning of this year up until last week. Now that is dedication. That's a lot of respect there. But thank you all guys for emailing in, and also on Twitter. Betangura William had a nice message, so big shout out to him as well. And now that couple of things here. We've had a lot of car releases this week. We've had the official trailer for season 3 of Drive to Survive come out. And a lot of the emails this week as well were, again, the Drive to Survive generation. Now, I consider myself very lucky because I grew up with Formula One. My dad, he was a Formula One fan. He used to go to Silverstone and Brands Hatch and places like that in the 60s to watch Formula One and other racing. Got to see a lot of the greats from that era. So I've been lucky to grow up with it. But on the other hand, I still can't help but feeling I've missed something. I feel a little bit jealous now that I'm not part of, like, it's like the Drive to Survive generation. It's a real thing, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's kind of funny, right? Like, you and I got into the sport back in the kind of the late 80s, the early 90s. And I think a lot of our listeners that are part of this Drive to Survive generation, they may hear this name, Bernie Eccleston. And Bernie, until 2016, 2017, when Liberty bought Formula One, he was like the head honcho. He owned a huge stake in the sport, but he oversaw everything. And he was absolutely adamant that he did not want to engage with social media, that all of the F1 content had to be paid, had to be behind a firewall. And he was also very clear that his target demographic, it wasn't us, it wasn't millennials, it wasn't 20-year-olds, it wasn't 30-year-olds. He wanted to chase those high-heeled, yacht-driving, Rolex-wearing, kind of super rich crowd. And if you look back at some of the sponsorships adorning the track 5-10 years ago, you would see a lot of that. And when Liberty came in, they're like, no, we need to totally reset this. We need to engage with social media, and we need a mechanism to bring a huge wave of new fans into the sport. And that's what Drive to Survive really did. Mm-hmm. And I saw a tweet last night, and I retweeted it. It was from Matt Gallagher at WTF1, and he basically said, Drive to Survive is the best thing to happen to F1 in recent times. You will never change my mind. And I completely agree. Nothing that could have happened on the track would have mattered if people weren't watching, but now people are watching. So fantastic, but totally agree.
Well, it's funny because, Drive to Survive season 3 comes out on what, March 19th or something? Yeah. So just 2 weeks from now. And we've watched the 2020 season. We've digested it. We've gone back and rehashed it. We've talked about it a lot on this program. I'm excited to go back and watch it again now in Drive to Survive form. I just feel like I need to do it justice and binge watch all right. Three, the previous two seasons and get it to season 3. But certainly very, very cool. And it was interesting too, going through the different generations of Formula One fans. So the email we had from Shauna Campbell, she's a new fan to Formula One. And she was saying that her partner's family, they're big Williams McLaren, they got like a big rivalry. And that to me kind of really is a throwback to like the late 80s and early 90s, Williams Honda, McLaren Honda. So I don't know. She didn't specifically say, but that kind of like, that was what the big rivalry was back in those days. And Sean has gone a little bit easy, and she acknowledges that she's made it difficult for herself by choosing to cheer for Haas. But I give her credit because she's decided to go against the trend from the rest of the family. And I love the black sheep attitude, the dare to
She may not be cheering for Haas after today, man. She may not be cheering for Haas after today. But yeah, kudos. Kudos for latching onto a team. And that's exciting too, because you get to forge your own Formula One identity, right? So exactly. Rather than just embracing a team that's kind of embedded in the kind of culture of your family, you can kind of start your own path, which is pretty cool.
Which is something I've always done. So I feel a certain kinship to her and her mentality to be different from the rest of the family. So
totally.
Mark, let's do it. We're going to borrow a little bit bit here because it's March. March Madness is a massive, it's one of the greatest tournaments in sports as far as I'm concerned. So we're going to do a little bit different. We're not obviously going to talk about NCAA basketball, but we're going to borrow the bracket idea and we're going to apply it to the Formula One grid because basically all the teams except for Ferrari, which is going to be red, they've released all their cars, they've had all their launches, and I really like it. It feels like a brand, like even though the cars are the same, they're different. I mean, underneath they're basically the same with the little tweaks, but I like how there's a lot of radical new ideas going on with the with what's on top, like on the bodywork itself. I think a lot of these cars look really, really great.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I thought, you know, we haven't done a great job of talking about the car launches over the last couple of weeks, and we keep inching closer and closer to the season. We're like, what, 21 days away from, like 3 weeks away from the first race weekend. Like, it's absurd how close we are, but we haven't done a great job of kind of looking at the cars and commenting on the cars. And I think we commented a little bit on the McLaren launch a couple of weeks ago because that was the first one and it was kind of a little bit splashy and it was kind of a little bit novel, but we haven't really talked about AlphaTauri and Red Bull and some of these other brands. So the thought was, why don't we just put this into a bracket? We kind of walk our way through the bracket and then ultimately we end up with a final winner. Like, hey, this is our favorite car. If you follow us on Twitter, and you totally should, we actually posted the bracket a couple of days ago. So if you want to go back and take a peek, you can. And what we also did is we posted a bunch of polls. So as we work our way through the bracket, I'll also be able to comment on the cars that our listeners chose. Now, I'll be honest, I'm not a mathematician, despite what my university degrees may suggest. And one of the things I really struggled with is I couldn't wrap my head around the concept of a 10-team bracket. And I basically had this big wall up and there was string and there was ink and there was black and white photos of people on the street. And like, I was trying to piece together how I could possibly create a 10-team bracket. And then I finally just Googled 10-team bracket. And it's like, you have to have two play-in teams. So I'm like, oh, you got to have two play-in brackets. So that's what we're going to do. And I think we kick this off then. So ultimately the intention of the bracket is we're going to keep pitting teams against each other. We'll pick a winner until we finally get to the two final teams. And we'll decide, like, hey, collectively, which is our favorite looking car? And to your point, some of this is just kind of initial impressions on the car. Some of this is what we know about the changes, but just kind of a high level snapshot of our initial impressions. And I've got a little bit of commentary for each of the cars, talking to some of the highlights in terms of tweaks and changes and things like that. But high level, this is just kind of first impression. It's not about the drivers. It's really not about anticipated performance, but just kind of our initial impression. So having said all of that, we have two play-in brackets to actually get into the tournament. So Alpine, F1, Haas, and then in the other play-in bracket, we have Alfa Romeo and AlphaTauri. So there's six teams that have already kind of made their way into the tournament, but these four teams are going to play their way in. So what we're going to do right now is start with the number 8 and the number 9 seeds. Okay. So we are going to pit Alpine F1 against Haas F1. So this one's kind of interesting. I will share right off the top, because I think we're probably going to land in very much the same place, that when we put this one in the poll on Instagram, resoundingly 100% of our listeners, and we'll get to why in a few seconds, chose the Alpine car, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
So your initial gut reactions between these two cars, let's start with the Alpine car. So the A521, it's, again, at least cosmetically, visually, it's a huge overhaul on last year's Renault, in part because they've changed the branding. Your initial impressions on the A521 by Alpine?
I really like it. I like the the traditional racing blue that they have on it, but I also like how on the back of the bodywork, on the back of the engine cowling, it's got the A and the red and a bit of the white. So I mean, you've got not only the traditional French racing blue, but you got the white and the red in there for the French flag. So I like it. I think it looks really good. It's a nice metallic-y blue. It really seems to me it's a nice rich deep color. I like it. I think it's a very, very nice looking car. And I think it looks pretty good to some of the mock-ups and some of the leaked photos that we saw and some of the teasers. So I think that it lived up to the hype. So I'm going with the Alpine on this one. I like it.
Yeah, so do I. I totally agree. I love the fact that they're really embracing the French heritage. Like, that delivery is really based around the colors of the French flags. In terms of the car itself, it isn't a significant, from a technical perspective, it's not a significant upgrade over the Renault RS20. Again, this year's kind of a stopgap until we get to 2022 when we see the total overhaul. Very similar outline, very similar side pods. Obviously, the floors changed based on the new regulations. The nose is similar, the front wing is similar. So cosmetically and structurally, it's not fundamentally different than last year's car. Mm-hmm. Obviously, from a visual perspective, it's totally different. Now, the Haas car, and I just want to comment on this one real quickly, because this car is stirring up a ton of controversy. I think the first thing is that, like the Alpine, Haas has made a very conscious decision not to spend their tokens and not to spend any money on the car. They're putting whatever resources they have at this point into the 2022 car. Where the controversy erupts is the livery. Mm-hmm. And at first glance, like, yeah, it's okay. It's white, it's red, it's blue. But when you look a little bit closer, you realize that's the Russian flag. Yes. And that's complicated for a couple of reasons. One, because at least as we understand it, Gene Haas is an American who wanted to bring an American team to the sport of Formula One. Two, we know that Mazepin and his father injected a ton of money into this team. His father's company, Uracali, which is also now the principal sponsor and naming sponsor of the team, has its branding all over the car. But what's also complicated about this is that the WADA, WADA, in partnership with the IOC, had levied a decision in December through the Court of Arbitration for Sport that Russian athletes effectively can't compete under the Russian flag for 2 years. So Mazepin actually can't have the Russian flag on this car because the Russian Automobile Federation and in turn FIA recognized the outcome of the results of that court decision. So one of the ways they seem to have got around this is basically like, hey, we can't have the Russian flag. Let's just make the entire livery the Russian flag. And there was a little bit of pushback, like, no, that's not what we're doing. But I found an interesting tweet the other day. So the company that actually designed this livery is a company called Brandon Saber Design. They're a design house. And they actually posted it and said, hey, look what we did. This is our new livery. And they got destroyed. But one of the people that posted says, who are you to put the flag of a totalitarian government on your car? And he's like, that's just what we were asked to do.
Yeah,
so he didn't decline it at all. So yeah, very, very strange that you have this American car wearing a Russian flag across its livery. And ultimately, they may have to completely overhaul it before the season begins. But like our listeners, totally agree. Haas, you're out. Alpine, you move on to compete against Mercedes. Next bracket, I'm going to let you go first here. So 7 seed versus this 8-10 seed. We have Alfa Romeo Racing against number 10, AlphaTauri Honda.
Yeah, this is a little bit tougher to get going here on this one here, because if you look at the AlphaTauri, what I really like about it, it's simple. It's sort of this dark navy blue with the white wheels, which I think look really, really good on the car. It's got the red on the side pods for the Honda. You know, it's nice. It's not too busy. It's got the big AlphaTauri logo on the side of the airbox. I think it's a nice looking car. If the ATO2, but then if you go and you look at the Alfa Romeo, I think this is a nice looking car as well. It's sort of this reddy maroon and the white on the rest of the bodywork with some black trim. Yeah. It's a nice looking car. You know, it's kind of difficult to pick one, but I'm going to give the slight edge to Alfa Romeo on this one.
Yeah, I do as well. The A202 from AlphaTauri, very similar. So structurally, cosmetically, not fundamentally different than last year's AT01. They've chosen not to make a ton of changes. Mechanically, the rear of the car is completely different. They did invest most of their tokens in the front. So if you kind of compare the two cars, you'll notice that the front suspension is very different. The front wing is very different. In turn, they had to do quite a lot of work on the steering geometry and the steering components. But ultimately, it's not fundamentally that different from kind of the driver cockpit backwards. And ultimately, the design isn't great. You did make a comment that you didn't mention now, which I'm kind of surprised about, is that I love the white wheels. Hmm. The white wheels, to me, harken back to the import tuner days of 20 years ago when people would be rolling around in their 2000 Electron Blue Honda Civic SIR with their white 16-inch Vogue T37 forged wheels. Like, I like that, but ultimately, I much, much, much prefer the C41. The color scheme is largely just kind of a revised or an inverted version of what we saw on the C39, but ultimately very, very cool. Now, again, very similar to AlphaTauri and a couple of those other teams that we spoke to, no real significant fundamental changes, but like our listeners, I agree, Alfa Romeo goes forward. They're going to compete against Scuderia Ferrari, and AlphaTauri, you're out. All right, let's go through the first bracket.
That's a bit of a tough one because the AlphaTauri is a nice car. And the other thing is, too, they've basically, like, they've inverted the colors from last year, which is predominantly white with the navy blue trim on. They're still nice-looking cars. Okay, so we move on now to round number two, or basically the quarterfinals. You know, it gets serious pretty quick when you only have 10 teams to go through. But there you go. Okay, so where do we kick it off now with the winner from the Alpine and Haas go up against Mercedes AMG F1?
Absolutely. I think that's where we go. So I'm going to let you share. I've got some thoughts, but I'll let you share your thoughts first on the Mercedes. So now Mercedes versus Alpine.
Yeah, the Mercedes, you know, honestly, I think that they've hit another home run with the car this year. I really loved the idea that they switched to the black livery for last year. But I mean, just basically they, you know, it was kind of a last minute thing, all the part of the Black Lives Matter thing, and you know how Lewis really took a stance on that. So I mean, they just basically replaced the black or the silver with the black, and then just put everything over top. But now this year, it's a little bit evolved from that. It's predominantly black on the nose, the side pods, on the airbox, and the back of the engine cowling. You have some that sort of dark reddy maroon on the top of the airbox for their sponsors Ineos, and also the driver or the car numbers on the back of the engine cowling on the fin for 77 for Valtteri, 44 for Lewis in maroon. And then also on the back of the airbox, you have like the AMG logos on there in like a white. It looks really, really, really good. And then of course you have that sort of that teal, the coloring from Petronas down the sides of the car, along the nose, around the cockpit, down along the airbox, and then the wheel rims, of course, that teal. Multiple colors at play, but it looks really, really, really good. You know, I really like the Alpine from you know, round one, but you know, Mercedes, I think they've got a real winner here. And you know, I don't know what everybody else is going to pick, but my pick to move through from this matchup is the Mercedes, the W12.
Yeah, I you know, I don't have a lot to add in terms of your observations, in terms of the cosmetics. The one thing that I was ecstatic about last year, and for those of that have been watching the sport for a while or haven't been, ever since Mercedes came back as a full-blown works team after buying the Braun team at the end of 2010, they've competed with a predominantly silver livery, and they've had some darker gray gradients and things like that. But last year, for the reason that you spoke, to embrace the BLM, the Black Lives Matter movement, they went to what I expected was going to be kind of a one-year black, predominantly black livery, and fingers crossed, I really wanted them to carry it over, and they did, and it's so good. I love everything cosmetically about the car. In terms of what we know about the design beyond the cosmetics and the livery, there's still a lot we don't know, and I don't think we're going to learn a lot more until the winter testing in Bahrain. What we do know is that the work they've done has really been a heavy emphasis on clawing back downforce lost to the new floor regulations. And we can talk about that a little bit more during our preview show. But really, they've spent a lot of time and a lot of energy kind of identifying and addressing and tweaking the aerodynamic components of the car. There's a shrunken engine cover. There's revised side pods. There's some slight modifications at the front, heavy carryover on the front and the rear suspension, because I think they largely mastered that last year. The one thing that I know a lot of our viewers and listeners have picked up on is there's a very large bulge over the engine cover. And James Allison says, and I quote, "The sexy bulge," quote unquote, above the side pod was hiding some of the work that that our friends at HPP have done to squeeze more horses into the PU. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, because we also see that same bulge on the Williams and on the Aston Martin. But ultimately, we won't actually see the full race spec F1 W12 until Bahrain. So what we've seen so far is a watered down version, simply because like a lot of teams, they've got a lot cooking and they don't want to spoil the secrets. They don't want the rest of the teams to know what's happening. But I totally agree. So for me, the team that's going to move on is the Mercedes. So Mercedes, you're moving on to the semifinals, which takes us to, and I'm going to let you kick this one off, we now have Williams with a heavily revised livery going up against McLaren with a livery that's not fundamentally different than the prior year.
And we'll certainly talk about that after we take our first break here on the show. So stick around and we'll keep going with our March Madness bracket. I almost got that out in one piece there. And we'll do so just after this quick break and a word from our sponsor. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, well, welcome back to the show, and all to all of you listening on the podcast and all of you watching on YouTube. Mark and Mark here. We are going through our March Madness Formula One bracket, and we've left it off now with our matchup in the quarterfinals between Williams and McLaren. Now, excuse me. Now, this is, well... I'm going to make it sound really easy because I've got my favorite out of the two here. So let's look at the Williams. So this is a team that now has new ownership. You know, it's basically a team that's rebuilding from the ground up. But with the FW43B, I think that they've done a really, really nice job. Like, excuse me. I think what they've done the past couple of years is that it's been nice, but for my liking, it's been a little bit vanilla. And what they've done, they've spiced it up a little bit more. It's a little bit more, what do you want to call it? I don't want to say abstract, but it's more avant-garde. You know, there's several colors at play. You've got the white nose on there. You've got a little bit of yellow, a couple of shades of blue. Then you've got this sort of vertical, diagonal striping across the airbox, the back of the cockpit, going over the engine cowling, back of the side pods, and going into the back of the engine cowling into the wings. This is like a dark navy blue or a black, and it looks really, really good. And I think it also kind of works. You know what? With having Nick Latifi there, he's sponsored by RBC. I've just noticed that there's a tie-in with the Royal Bank of Canada colors there, but I think it's a decent looking car. But you know, when you put it up against the McLaren, the MCL35M, you have the papaya on the top side of the car over the nose, the cockpit going onto the airbox, the engine cowling, and then you have like this metallic-y the blue color as well, which I think really looks really, really good. And then you have the Gulf sponsoring, which is kind of a throwback to days gone by, long before either of us were Formula One fans. But I just love the fact that, and I'm a sucker for this in any sport. You know, I love teams that go with traditional colors, and there's always like a modern twist on it, but I like when you stay with like the modern colors. I mean, when it comes to like our local hockey team, the Vancouver Canucks, I love those Pacific Northwest colors, the sort of dark medium blue, the greens, the white. It's very Pacific Northwest, and that's why I really, really like the McLaren. I mean, the Williams gets great, don't get me wrong, but that papaya is just so sexy. It just really, really looks good.
Yeah, I agree. And, one of the things that I've started to pick up on with the FW43B, the new Williams competitor, is I actually do love the design. In fact, I thought the design of the past 2 years were kind of, they were tied up with Rocket for a year and a half before Rocket bailed halfway through the season. I thought that design was garbage. I thought it was under-designed. I didn't think it was time. There was no timeliness to it. It was one of those designs that was going to date very quickly. It felt very interim, very rushed, very low cost. This, to me, seems more permanent. And if you look at if you step back and you look at the FW43B, one of the things you'll notice is, especially with those yellow accents, it harkens back to the Williams of the mid-90s when they were winning titles. Now, for me, that's a little bit problematic because, again, that was a tie-up with a tobacco manufacturer that kind of brought that white and the blue and the yellow. Yep. But ultimately, I'm really, really impressed with the car. In terms of construction, it's not fundamentally different than the 2020 car, which unfortunately isn't fundamentally different than the 2019 car, but they have done a couple of things. So there's some subtle reworking. They've done quite a lot of work around the side pods. They've done quite a lot of work around the engine cover area. Again, that's largely to accommodate the new Mercedes M12 EPU. They've had to do some work around the floors. Again, that's more kind of regulation driven. It is believed, and I should mention this as well, that the bulge that we're seeing around the engine cover, the side pods on the Mercedes, the Aston Martin, and the Williams, it's believed it's to accommodate a new variable inlet system that Mercedes's HPPU unit developed during the off season. So apparently that's supposed to crank up the horsepower and make power more available on demand. So that's pretty exciting. They've got largely the same front suspension, the same nose is retained. The front ring is revised pretty significantly, but then it's been revised largely to accept the challenge that is presented by the reduced downforce from the changes to the reduced floor coverage. But overall, I think it's an exceptionally good looking car relative to where they've been.
Yep.
The Mercedes and the MCL 35M, gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. I love the orange, the papaya, because I can't pronounce that word, papaya, right?
Yeah, papaya, yeah.
it's beautiful. The M at the end of MCL 35M stands for Mercedes. This is the first year since 2014 that they're going to run a Mercedes engine after a stint with Honda and then a shorter stint with Renault. Ultimately, this team has had to massively revise the back end of this car, spend all of their tokens, spend all of their money to accommodate a completely fundamentally different power unit. By all accounts, they've done an exceptionally good job. They spent both of their two permitted power units just to get that power unit into the back of the car. The rear of the car is vastly different as a result. We have to talk about revised aerodynamics and suspension and all those different kind of components. The front wing and the front end is very, very similar. Now, for me, and I think there's going to have to be a tiebreaker, I can't vote for the MCL 35M because of the A Better Tomorrow tie-up. I can't vote for them because of that tobacco tie-up. But I think we're going to have a tiebreaker here. And the tiebreaker is going to be which of these two teams scored more championship points last year.
Well, that's obviously McLaren. But, you know the whatever that was, the Better Tomorrow thing, at least they've gotten away from, you know, the MP labeling of their cars, the old Marlboro project that went back to the Ron Dennis tie-up and everything like that. So, I mean, you know, it's like the whole mission win now thing that Ferrari has going on. But yeah,
totally.
I mean, also just before we move on from this pairing, the other thing I like too with the Williams is like that diagonal striping, that sort of transitional thing on the side of the car behind the cockpit. And I also like how they've sort of worked in onto the top of the airbox behind the cameras is that stylized W that the Williams team has a logo. I think that looks pretty cool, but
I hadn't actually noticed that until you mentioned it.
Well, look, you know, at first glance, it doesn't really, you know, at least from the press photos, it might be completely different when we see it on the track. But they're both very, very nice cars, and I think, you know, going with the tiebreaker with the championship points, I think that's a fair way to decide that one. So let's move on to our next bracket. I don't even think that this is a contest. Next matchup is Aston Martin against Red Bull. Shall we discuss it? I think we need to discuss
it. Let me just get the Red Bull out of the way, and then I'll let you lead with the Aston Martin. So the RB16B is based on what we've seen so far, is the livery is garbage. I'm sick of this livery. We've seen it for the entire run of the team in the sport. There's nothing to comment on here. It's the same yellows, orange, reds, dark navy blues. It's a matte finish. It's not glossy. Fundamentally, it looks like every other Red Bull that's come before it. Thank goodness they've moved away from the pinstripes that they had at the earlier part of the last decade, but fundamentally nothing's changed. They're calling this the RB16B rather than the RB17. There will be no RB17. So next year when we go to the Red Bull branded power unit, they're going to skip ahead to the RP18. Largely the same. The one thing that's very unclear right now is what the final spec's going to look like. So the photos that have been shared so far are interesting because, one, they've been heavily doctored with a lot of very dark areas as the team's working to conceal a lot of the aerodynamic changes that they've made. And interestingly, when they did a filming day at Silverstone a couple of weeks ago, they had both the RB15 and the RB16B on the track, but the photos that they released afterwards were only of the RB15, the 2019 car. So they're going above and beyond to conceal what the final product looks like. They're desperately trying to conceal it. Now, it is understood that they've significantly reworked the rear suspension to adopt the Mercedes-style track rod lower arm configuration that Mercedes had for a couple of years now. But so far, we don't know anything about it. But from an initial appearance perspective, blah, Nothing here appeals to me. I'm sick of this design. I'm ready for them to try something new.
Well, you know, I think it completely can be summed up by the tweets that they put out at the launch was same but different. You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is from Red Bull themselves. And I mean, you know, like I was saying just now, like I love the traditional tie-ins and things like that. But, you know, like you say, we've seen the same variation on this for far too many years. And, you know, we've even seen it watered down to a certain extent with the Toro Rosso. I mean, when they rebranded to AlphaTauri last year, I mean, you still see that, but at least they're kind of doing a bit of a, you know, that's different now. I know it's the clothing line compared to the energy drinks and whatnot, but I mean, you know, guys, you're a major Formula One team. You're so innovative in so many other aspects. You know, apply that to the, you know, the, you know, I'm all for branding and whatnot. That's fine. But, you know, let's be a little bit more, you know, unique, a little bit more creative for the RB 18 for next year.
I want to add one thing real quick. And sure. You, because you're so passionate about football, soccer, and I think a lot of our listeners probably know that, having listened to you for a while. In European football, I was always struck growing up with how rapidly teams change their kit. Like, it was every 3 years, and it was every 2 years, and now you see teams evolving and completely transforming their kit every year. And at the end of the day, it's to drive merchandising sales.
Of course.
And over here in North American sports, that was a foreign concept. Like, teams might have the same fundamental design for decades, but even over here now, the NHL, the NBA, teams have 5 sets of uniforms. They change them every year, but it's all driving around merchandising. And I think what we've seen in Formula One is that teams really innovate, except for maybe Ferrari, because they've got a kind of a traditional design, and that's part of their branding and all that kind of stuff. But you see teams turning over designs very quickly, because for the same reason, they want to sell merchandise. Mm-hmm. But Red Bull has been stuck in this rut, and maybe they're just comfortable with it, but I'm ready to see something different. And maybe next year when they go all in and they introduce the RB18, actually, you know what? I'm going to put my money on it. With the RB18, when they've got their own power unit, I would put money on the fact that they're going to try something fundamentally new, and I hope they do. But they're due for something. They're due for something.
Well, you know, just to maybe go off on a bit of a tangent and build what you're just saying there, just about North American teams.
That's what we do.
So, you know, when it comes to the branding, the colors, and everything like that, let's take the Toronto Raptors. They came into the NBA mid '90s. The Raptors, great name, but the tie-in was very Jurassic Park, very mid '90s. The sort of pastel-y colors and things like that, and the very cartoonish dinosaur. Exactly. But now you move forward 2 decades. The colors that they've gone to, like that nice deep red, very simple. And I've always thought that one of the best uniforms in sports is the Chicago Bulls. You know, the white, the red, the white, the black trim. And the Raptors have done something very similar. And I always think that there's something very, very appealing and simple with proper accents, a nice solid color. And I think the Raptors are a perfect example of a team that has maybe evolved and really come to understand that better over the years. Now we go away from Red Bull and you come back to a team now that's back in Formula One after what, 61 years or something?
Yep, 60 years, baby.
60 years. And it's the Aston Martin, the AMR 21. I love the naming. I love it simple. You know, it's nice and easy to remember, rather than just to sort of a build on to every year. I mean, like you have with the Williams, the FW43B or whatever it is this year. But anyways, what I love about the Aston Martin, they're playing on history. They're keeping it traditional. This beautiful British racing green with like the metallic finish to it. You know, it's got the nice sort of pink highlights on it with the BWT sponsoring. The majority of the advertising on there, the main title sponsor, Cognizant, that's white. You know, I think it's just a beautiful looking car. It's got some black on there as well. I think it looks wonderful. This is for me one of the ones that should have been fast tracked right through to the final rounds. But you know, due process and all, right?
Yeah, due process. I totally agree. And if you've been listening to the show over the last couple of months, we've been waiting and counting down. One, because we wanted to see the merch, and two, we wanted to see the car. And it's funny because everything that I wanted it to be is what the end product is. And what's really curious about the design is you're going to pick up on the fact that despite the fact that it's predominantly this beautiful, rich, kind of vibrant and not too dark, not too fern British racing green, there's some beautiful pink accents.
Yeah.
Those pink accents that you're actually seeing in the photos and on the merchandise right now are actually lime. So we've reported, we stole information from the web that BWT was in negotiations with Haas and Williams up until a couple of weeks ago. And then apparently those negotiations negotiations fell apart and they went back to Aston Martin. They signed a deal, but the team had already produced all their merchandise and shot all their catalog photos. And all of the photos of the cars that were shown on the launch day were already taken. So that pink strip was originally lime and they had to go and open up the Adobe Creative Suite, change it to pink. But I love the pink. I love everything about the car. And I think from a technical perspective, the other major consideration here too is that this is, despite the work that McLaren had to do, this is considered the most technologically and technically evolved car of the 2021 grid, massively overhauled. It's a dramatically different car than the RB20, which unfortunately was a kind of a carryover from 2019, which was a massive carryover from 2018. This is a significantly reworked car, massively revised front wing, front nose, new side pods, new radiator inlets, massively changed barge boards, the floors, of course, the rear wing. They were allowed to do a token-free upgrade to the 2020 Mercedes rear suspension, which they did, but ultimately they continued to invest everywhere else in the car. And one of the most noticeable things you're going to see once we start getting this car on track is it has the same bulge on the engine cover and the side pod to accommodate that variable inlet valve system that the HPP team has designed. Overall, this car is total fire. It's yep. classic. It's traditional. It's everything I want it to be. And the only thing I'm disappointed by is I rushed to buy merchandise, and it's, as expected, F1 merchandise is notoriously, horrendously expensive, especially for Canadians because we have to pay duties and shipping and all those kind of things. This car is absolute fire. It moves on to the next round. No questions
Absolutely.
Asked.
Absolutely. Just before
we I'll say as well, our listeners, again, 100% voted for this over the Red Bull.
Yeah, and so they should. I mean, it's not even a contest, in my opinion. But the other thing that I just wanted to mention before we move on to the next the next matchup is that when you see some of these press photos for the different cars, exactly, you're just holding it up there, you know, for people to see on YouTube. But the one thing I find that's more apparent compared to say the Mercedes and the McLaren that we've looked at so far is the side view. That bulge on the side of the cowling is much more apparent in these press photos for the Aston Martin compared to the others. I know it's lighting and everything like that, but it is rather prominent. It's probably about 18 inches to 2 feet long,
yeah,
and probably about I'd probably say about 8 inches wide, and who knows how far it sticks out. The depth is kind of hard to estimate, but it's quite obvious on the Aston Martin.
Totally.
All right.
So we move on. Do we have time for another? Actually, we should probably take a break, I'm guessing, right? Probably overdue.
Yeah, let's take one more break here, and then we'll move on because we got this one bracket, which I think is going to be a simple one to do, and then we're on to the semis. So let's take another quick break here on the Overtime Media Network. You're listening to Scuderia F1, Mark Daly, Mark Hamilton, and we'll be back in just a minute to keep going on with our March Madness. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, well, welcome back to the show here on the Overtime Media Network. We are borrowing heavily from the NCAA and our own version of March Madness. We're counting down and ranking the best-looking cars that have been released so far for the Formula One 2021. Not ready to say that yet. 2021 World Championship, which gets going in just under 3 weeks, and can't wait for that. Okay, so we're now basically down to the last pairing, and then it gets really, really serious. We're off to the semis. So the last pairing we have is the Ferrari and the Alfa Romeo. And well, you know, the Ferrari, they haven't officially done their release yet, but you know, you can always bank on it. It's going to be red, and based on what we've seen over the past couple of years, we're going to make an educated guess that it's going to be very, very similar to last year's car. Mark, what do you want to add to that?
Nothing. You know, we don't know a lot about the car. We still honestly don't know a lot about the power unit that they're going to be running or the power unit that they're going to be supplying to Haas or Alfa Romeo. But I think really the question is it going to have a glossy finish or are they going to go matte? That's about all that really matters. I mean, I think that the Ferrari designers really have to work within some really strict brand guidelines and they don't have a lot of room to take creative liberty. So I think generally we have a pretty good idea what it's going to look like. Yeah. It's going to be red and there's going to be a splash of black and a splash of yellow. That's about it.
Well, you know, the thing that that looked really, really good was that the paint scheme, that livery that they adopted for the 1,000th Grand Prix at Mugello last year.
Right.
That real scarlet blood red, that was, you know, if you said the Aston Martin was fire, that was fire. But I mean, nowadays you have the more sort of that orangey kind of red, which, you know, is, I guess you could say is still a tie-in to the whole Philip Morris, yeah, Marlboro thing. So, you know, as much as I like Ferrari, and I think that paint scheme, even if it's got the lighter color, not the traditional scarlet, maroon, red, whatever you want to call it, I'd have to say that I'm going to give the edge to the Alfa Romeo. I'm just going to be different. I'm just going to give it. I'm going to give it to Alfa because I don't think Ferrari should just get an automatic pass because they're Ferrari.
Yeah, unfortunately, we agree. So there hasn't been a lot of controversy in the bracket so far, outside of the Better Tomorrow comment. But ultimately, I think it's a beautiful car. It's a timeless design. They made some changes. I really do like, and I've been very happy, not necessarily with the performance of the Alfa Romeo experiment since they kind of partnered up with the Swiss Sauber team, but I do think it's a beautiful, timeless car. And for me, I would give it the edge simply because they continue to evolve on a really strong brand identity. I love the branding on the engine cover, on the rear side pods with the snake. Like, it's a beautiful car. I would absolutely, which means we move on to two semifinal brackets. We're going to see McLaren against Mercedes, and we're going to see Aston Martin against Alfa Romeo. And I think I'm starting to get a pretty good understanding of what the final is going to look like, but I don't know because I can't read your mind. So I'm going to pass it off to you. We don't need to speak in detail about the cars because we've accomplished this at this point. But for you, McLaren versus their now partner, Mercedes.
Yeah, as much as I like the McLaren this year, and I think that it's a beautiful looking car. Like I said, in the previous segment, I really love that papaya and the branding on it. I think it looks really, really good. I just think that the Mercedes and that transition paint scheme that they have from the black to the silver to the gray and everything, just sort of moving down the car. I think that for me, going through the semifinal number one, I think you have to give it to Mercedes.
I totally agree. I love black cars. Black cars, especially black racing cars, are very, very difficult to pull off. Mm-hmm. I think they've done an exceptional job. I think the green accents, I think the red Ineos accents. I love the AMG branding covering the engine cover at the back of the car. That pattern, that AMG pattern, it almost looks like a camo pattern with that lighter gray gradient fading up to white towards the edge of the shark fin. To me, it's beautiful. Again, I think the McLaren's a lovely looking car. I struggle with that tie up. And you're right, it's not as bad as a traditional tobacco based product push. Mm-hmm. I don't love that. But to me, even if that was on that car, I would still absolutely give the edge to Mercedes, which means that they go to the final.
Final. Okay. So that's semifinal number one. Semifinal number two puts the Aston Martin against the Alfa Romeo. Do you want to take this one, or shall I lead it off?
Oh, are we even going to do this? I thought we were just skipping. I thought it was pretty much, I'll let you take it, but I think you and I both probably are going to land on the same place.
Yeah, well, you know, as much as I applaud Alfa, and I really like that the scheme and the livery that they've gone with this year, I think that the Aston Martin just looks too good. So I think that they obviously move right through to the final, where we will now have the Mercedes Works team against the Aston Martin customer Mercedes team for the final. And I think that these are both two wonderful, really, really nice looking cars. I don't know. You want to take it? Do you want to pick the winner?
Yeah. So I think for me, and obviously, and again, I'm heavily criticized for being a Mercedes homer, a Lewis, I was going to say LeBron James, but that's true, but a Lewis Hamilton homer. And I wear this hat, but largely because of convenience, because it's near and my hair gets destroyed with a pair of headphones. Obviously I love the Mercedes. I love what they had evolved into last year when they took on that black identity and they tied it into the Black Lives Matter movement. So as far as the cars were concerned on the grid last last year. I think the Mercedes was the best looking car. I liked the pink of the Racing Point, but I always felt that everything Racing Point was doing was interim. They didn't want to invest in that identity because they always had a longer term picture. They always had a long-term plan. And Racing Point, the name, the branding, the colors, the livery, even the fact that if you went to the Racing Point site, there was no merchandise to buy. They didn't want to invest in that identity because they knew it was temporary. So I love the Mercedes, but for me, the Aston Martin is timeless. It's clean. They've done such an exceptional job of working in the branding, their sponsorship branding components as well. I think oftentimes you have a great livery, but your brand partners, your sponsors, aren't comfortable compromising their own branding identity. So sometimes you basically get this beautiful green livery or this red livery, but then you have a sticker on the car from one of your sponsors and it's in 17 different colors because that's their identity. Mm-hmm. I think they've done a really great job working with their sponsors, convincing their sponsors to do a white on green look. Again, there's an exception at the back with JCB, but I love it. I love the pink accents. For me, this is the best looking car on the grid. It's going to be the most identifiable car on the grid in a lot of circumstances as well. For me, Aston Martin wins.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very identifiable, like you say, just like the Ferrari is. I mean, you know, you don't have to look more than half a second to figure out where one of the Ferraris are because that scarlet red just jumps out of the jumps off of the track at you. And I think that the Aston Martin is very, very much the same thing. And you know, when I heard that there was going to be this continued tie up between the team and BWT, I'm like, okay, well, you know, we've seen this whole pink Mercedes thing. You know, now this is maybe morphing into the green Mercedes conversation, but that's a different discussion for a different day. But when I heard that they were going to continue to sponsor Aston Martin, I was just like, well, how's that going to work? I mean, obviously, right, this car is going to be heavily British Racing Green. They're pink. I mean, these are two completely polar opposites on the spectrum. And I like how that they did it. I mean, if it was going to be this British Racing Green and the lime green accents, that would have been a very nice paint scheme as well. But the pictures that we've seen, that pink stripe that we see across the front wing down the side of the car, very much similar to how Mercedes do it with that teal stripe along the midsection of the car, I think it looks really, really good. And I've always been a big fan of this color, and I even had a British Racing Green MG way back in the day. So there, I was always going to be impartial, or biased towards this one. And, you know, I hate for the fact that, we always agree with one another. I know that the listeners are probably like, come on, you guys, you got to disagree and get into a really good, argument about something for once. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, this is tough to argue against.
It was too obvious, man. It was too obvious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if we debated this, it would come across as inauthentic and like they're just trying to have a hot take. it was too obvious. The one thing I will add is I actually think that there's going to be an even better looking car on the track at times this year than the Aston Martin. And that's that this year we're going to see a British Racing Green with the lime accents Aston Martin safety car this year. And again, we tweeted this. It looks ridiculous, especially with the safety car branding, especially with the lights. Beautiful. But yeah, I think it was just too obvious. And I think we could have pushed it and been inauthentic and kind of taking opposing sides. But ultimately, the Aston Martins is fresh. It's new. It's traditional. It's classic. It's clean. Like every kind of stereotype that you could apply in terms of a branding kind of analysis, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, too, I mean, you mentioned it nicely just now, too, the fact that Racing Point never really heavily invested in that. And obviously, they made a big step forward last year. I mean, they had a much better year. They won a race, right, and they were just a much more exciting team to watch. The car was better. But, you know, the thing is, now that I've seen, you know, the Aston Martin, I mean, I've been excited about this for the past several months. But, you know, now that I've seen, you know, they've been teasing it for the past, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, or basically since New Year's. And now that we've seen the car, like, I feel really excited about this. I can look at this. I feel an immediate connection. I feel there's like an immediate identity. I feel the connection to the history of the name of Aston Martin. I feel like this is a team I could really get pumped up. I could really get invested in as a fan and cheer for. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, you were saying just now that all the merch is sold out, and, you know, the fact that you're willing to play the exorbitant prices for a t-shirt, or a hat or a jacket just to get it shipped to North America really says something. But it is a really, really good car, and I'm a really good looking car, and I'm really looking forward to see this. I mean, they've really done a lot of work to really set the foundations in multiple areas. I really, you know, as much as I, you know, tend to be a Zach Brown fanboy for McLaren, and, you know, he's done a very, very good job in his tenure at McLaren to really turn that team around, get them pointed and headed in the right direction. I think that maybe Otmar Szafnauer is maybe a little bit undermentioned in these conversations. I mean, sure, Lawrence Stroll is putting a lot of money into this team. He's invested heavily in the F1 project in the parent company in Aston Martin. I mean, that is a massive amount of capital that he's been putting into this team off and on the track, right? But the thing is, there still needs to be somebody, and as good as a businessman that Lawrence Stroll is, you need somebody that is more of an expert. I mean, Lawrence is an expert in his own field, but Otmar, you know, he's more of an expert on the operations, the running of a Formula One team, and I think that maybe he may get overlooked in some of these combinations. So I think you got good ownership, obviously, off the track. I think you got a good guy running the team on the track. You've got a good design team, and you've got a four-time world champion in Sebastian Vettel, who Szafnauer says he really believes that they can get the best out of, or at least they're hoping. And of course, the one real question mark this year is, how good is the car? Is it going to be better than last year? Because the RP20 was a very, very good car. It certainly had its moments last year, but I think it really, really left a lot of questions answered, because I think you could tell at times that it really needed a driver that was capable to take that thing by the scruff of the neck and really put it through the ringer to really get it was capable of. So, I mean, there are some questions about Sebastian Vettel just based on his past history over the past year and a half, maybe going back to the end of 2018. And then Lance Stroll, young guy, a lot of questions about him. You know, he's good enough to be in Formula One, obviously, but How much better can he get, or has he reached the ceiling? So, I mean, we've talked about it so many times, Mark, that there's so many questions and so many interesting threads to look at and pull on for this year. But for me, I think Aston Martin is going to be one of the biggest ones to watch right from, well, basically next week, whenever we get to winter testing down Bahrain.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to say as well, I own Mercedes merch, just because when you go to a race, you got to wear a little bit of merch, and it's easy to cheer for Mercedes because they do things the right way and they have a great leadership structure and they have great charismatic drivers, or at least in Lewis, it's easy to cheer for Lewis. And if you're a Lewis fan, it's easy to become a fan of Mercedes. But for me, I've never been able to truly identify with that team because I kind of jumped on the Mercedes bandwagon partway down their success journey. And for me, like when Lawrence Stroll came in and he bought a big chunk, or he bought the majority stake in Force India, like they were relatively competitive relative to the resources that they had to put on the track. But all of a sudden you had a Canadian that was buying in this team. So it was exciting to be able to jump into that journey at that stage. And it's been really fun to kind of cheer him along from a business perspective. And you make a great point about Otmar as well, that I think one of the best things that Lawrence has done is, look, I'm going to take care of everything from a business operations perspective. I'm going to build the brand. I'll invest in the factory. I'll give you the resources to do what you need to do. But the best thing that Lawrence has done is given Otmar space to manage the team operations. Like, I will look after business operations, sponsorship, revenue. I will leave you to look after team operations. And I think that's given him the space. And of course, with the infusion of the capital injection that he's been able to provide and all those kind of pieces, he's been successful. That said, I'm also now excited to actually own some Aston Martin F1 merchandise. The prices are killers, man. Like, if you look at the site, it's like $72 US for sure. And when you factor in duties and shipping and all that kind of stuff, it's close to $150 Canadian to grab some of these stuff. I'll mention as well that they also have a beautiful 3-in-1 team jacket for $624 US. They have a sleeveless vest for 161 US, which would probably come out to 250 Canadian once it gets here. And then a hat, an Aston Martin F1 hat, is about $50. Now, this isn't intended as a criticism, because all Formula One merch is notoriously expensive and notoriously low quality for the most part. but I think they're going to make a killing this year. And I cannot wait to see what the grandstands, because you commented last week that Silverstone is expecting a full house. And given the fact that almost half the population of that country, at least half the population of half the adult population, is now vaccinated, that's looking more realistic by the day. I cannot wait to see how much green you see in the grandstands on race day at that event come June, July, whenever it is. That's going to be exciting, because I guarantee you there will be a sea of green and lime.
Oh, I think they're going to be a big buy-in from the British sporting public. I think that that this is like a marketing home run, especially if this is a competitive team. And though, just going back to Lawrence Stroll, though, and what you were saying about how he takes care of the business and leaves everything to Safnauer to operate. And let's face it, I mean, when he came into Formula One, it was more like, okay, here's Lance Stroll. His dad's bought him into Formula One. Then he bought into Racing Point, and there's just okay, now he's bought a team for his son. But I mean, those are very, I think that's low hanging fruit when it comes to the criticisms and things like that. And slowly but surely, we've seen his plan evolve, and we've seen the buy into not only to Racing Point, but then the whole Aston Martin thing, and seen it unfold. I mean, in his other business areas, I mean, he's uber successful. He's a very wealthy man, very successful. And when it comes to things like that, you don't become that successful by being a micromanager. I mean, he has to do his due diligence, make sure everything's operating. But it's like I always make that comparison about, or I'll make the comparison now with the McLaren. Zach Brown comes in as the CEO, appoints key people in key areas. Sure, you got to check in with them, make sure everything's going good, give them what they need to do, support them where needed. You're not going to be successful if you're Zach Brown, you're micromanaging everything that Andreas Seidel is doing, everything James Key is doing, and so on, right? And the same thing is going to work or not going to work in that example at Aston Martin. If you're Lawrence Stroll and you're sitting there basically looking over Safnauer's shoulder 24/7, it's not going to go good. So it's just fascinating to see where this is going to go, and I really, really look forward to see how it's going to go with their first outings on the track. For testing, and of course, how that translates to hopefully success, on the track, right? And it's just, I can't talk about it enough, or maybe I talk about it too much. It's just one of those stories I just can't help but constantly, almost obsessing about.
Yeah, and I think the only criticism that I think is maybe even potentially remotely relevant is that wave of criticism that you saw in 2017. Because remember, initially, Lance Stroll was partnered up with the Williams team. He came straight out of F3, where he won a title. He went into F1 in 2017. He did have a podium in a terrible car. Obviously, that partnership was really driven, no pun intended, by the fact that the Lawrence Stroll put a ton of capital into Williams. And I think he realized pretty quickly that, one, maybe the team wasn't necessarily going to be for sale, because I think he had an appetite to buy an F1 team even then. Either he didn't sense that there was going to be an opportunity to buy that team, or he sensed that the team was in such total disarray. And he made some very public comments towards the end of 2018 that he wasn't satisfied with the outcome of the capital that he was putting into that team. I think he's done everything well. And I think the criticism is like, you know what, he's doing this, he's putting his son in a seat, but at the same time, his son picked up a podium in a terrible 2017 Williams car. And you can be critical about 2018, but that car was an absolute non-factor on the grid. 2019, I was disappointed with Lance. I'll be very honest about that. 2020, I think we saw some low points, but we also saw some incredible flashes. The guy picked up two podiums. He could have won a race, should have won a race in Turkey, if not for the front wing damage. He qualified on pole in Turkey in the right. Like he's more than capable of being at this level. But having said that, I also don't believe that Lawrence Stroll is a bad businessman. Like, a bad businessman doesn't build a business empire and put himself in a position where he can spend hundreds of millions of dollars US investing in a Formula One team and investing in Aston Martin, the road car division. Like, ultimately, I don't believe that he's going to keep Lance in that seat long term if he doesn't believe he can compete. And I think this is, hey, look, you know what? I'm going to partner you, and we've talked about this before. I'm going to partner you with Sebastian Vettel because he's a world champion. He's a great guy. He's charismatic. He's willing to teach and coach and help you. And I think ultimately, if he puts him through this journey for a year or two and Lance is ultimately not the best driver for that seat and there's somebody else available, I don't think Lawrence is going to hold on to him. I honestly don't. I think there's a bigger picture here and is winning a title. And if Lance can help you do that, great. But if he's not going to help you win a title, I think he'll move on.
Well, you know, that's a great point, and that's a perfect place to leave it, because, you know, they've said this week that they are aiming to win a title within the next 5 years. Now, I'll be honest, when I heard Renault say that, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, after they took over the whole Lotus project and rebranded, I have to admit that I fell for it. I felt that based on what we'd seen in the early 2000s, the double world championships that Fernando won in 2005, 2006, and based on previous success that they had in Formula One, I felt, I think 5 years as a reasonable time frame for them to get back to where they want to be or where they're aiming for in Formula One. That's to win races, get on podiums, and ultimately compete and win a championship. You know, however, you know, lofty aspirations in reality sometimes don't line up, and they've fallen far short of that mark now, because they've been back in what, since 2015 now,
2015.
Right? Yeah. So I mean, we're beyond that 5 year window, and they only finally got their first couple of podiums last year for multiple reasons that we've talked about, just because of the number of podiums that were vacated because Ferrari were so rubbish last year. So,
yeah.
But, you know, on the flip side, when I hear Aston Martin say that, you know, we want to compete for a title in 5 years, I feel that there's a real kernel, a real nugget of something there to build from, just based on all these things that we've seen. It's not like it's coming out of nowhere. There are signs that there are good things happening. You know, you've got good drivers, you've got a good car. We've seen flashes of the car. I mean, it hasn't obviously been without controversy. I mean, they had that the penalty applied to them last year, and all those rolling protests after races through the first quarter or third of the season. Right. But you know, all that notwithstanding, I mean, there's enough behind it, this team, to make me think this is more than idle boasting or idle wishful thinking. I really feel that 5 years based on this group seems like that something special could happen. Now, whether or not that happens, that of course remains to be seen, how it plays out over the next couple of years. But this is one team I'm very excited to watch over the next couple of years. And if they become the great disruptor, I think it'd be a great thing for Formula One.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's all I've got.
Okay. Well, let's take another break here, Mark. We're going to come back. There are a couple of items that were in the news this week that I want to run down and talk with you. And we'll do so here on our final break on the Overtime Media Network. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the podcast. As always, up to speed with Formula One. And Mark, we've been through on the first hour. We've ranked the grid so far for 2021. Undeniably, undoubtedly, undisputed champion, at least in looks, is the AMR 21. Hey, I remembered that. I'm ahead of the game if I can remember some of the car names, this early on to the preseason. Anyways, there are a couple of things that I do want to talk, and maybe in interest of brevity, maybe some of these ones, especially the sprint races, this seems to be a discussion that won't go away. But there was a couple of things that really, sort of stuck out of me. So one of them was, first of all, I want to start with Ferrari. So first of all, team principal Mattia Binotto said that he's going to spend more time in Maranello this year to help focus on next year, which I think is they're really ultimately targeting for a return to, competitive racing. I mean, we talked about it last week that perhaps the handicap that was imposed on them last year was this fuel map, which we saw, with the other Ferrari cars. But, that discussion, aside, I mean, I think it makes sense for Binotto to spend more time back at the factory at Maranello, if that's what they're really focusing on. I mean, we saw him do that a couple of times last year. I mean, we're still slated for a 23-race season. Now, whether or not that ultimately comes to pass, I mean, we're still living in a pandemic. I mean, there is some light at the end of the tunnel here, but, we're not sure if all these dates and races are going to go off as planned. So perhaps it's going to be 23, perhaps it's going to be something less, but whatever it is, I think that it's still ambitious. And I think that if you're focusing that much on this big project, and I think that, this big rebuild, I think that it makes perfect sense for him to spend more time in the factory and delegate some of these duties like he did in 2020.
We talked about this before, right? And yeah. And I don't think this is necessarily going to be an experience that we see relegated or unique to Ferrari. I just think ultimately, if you're going to have 23 or 24 or 25 race seasons, it means that if the team principal travels to every one of those races, they will literally never be at the factory. And I think that these team principals and some of these other members of the leadership team, they need the ability to oversee what's happening at the factory, and they need to physically be present to see the development of the cars. Because again, for those that are new to the sport, the car that the team brings to winter testing in March is often fundamentally different than the car that gets rolled out at the end of the season. And sometimes it is, but store or teams still have a lot of creative license to evolve the car throughout the season. And you might show up at the first race of the season and realize we've got some major downforce issues and we need to start working on that within the constraints of the Formula One formula or guidelines. But ultimately, I think we're going to see a lot of this. I just think Ferrari's going to be kind of at the pushing edge, but I think we're going to see more and more of this. I think Ferrari in particular is going to need to kind of push the envelope in this direction simply because they were a team that was so woefully uncompetitive last year and that they need to be in a position where he's overseeing not only incremental updates to the 2021 car, but he needs to be at the pulse of the development on the 2022 car. I think ultimately there'll be a little bit of forgiveness in the world of Ferrari in Italy if they're not hyper-competitive this year, because I think people understand that the penalty imposed by Liberty and Formula One and FIA ultimately kind of, I would say, led to a really unproductive 2020 season and possibly an unproductive 2021 season, unless the fuel map is kind of freed up this year and they can kind of get some of that performance back. But ultimately, I think the expectations are exceedingly high for 2022. And Binotto and some of his other team have also commented about the fact that they expect really substantial performance gains and competitive advantages for 2022. So I think absolutely he's going to have to, but I think we're going to see it from other teams as well. Like if you're going to have a 23 or 24 or 25 race season, your core leadership team members need to be able to split their time. And I think we're going to see this with all the teams where team principals will be absent and deputy team principals are going to have to step up and take over race weekends.
Or as you see with Renault, they don't have a team principal at all. And they basically divide that role between some of the senior management. I mean, Toto's even said the same thing, even going back to last year, that this new redefined role that he has within the Mercedes is going to give him the ability to stay away from some of the races. And, you know, more to your point with Ferrari, I do agree that there is some room for forgiveness in 2021. But I mean, even going back to last year, they've been even saying that they're targeting 2022 to a real return to competitiveness. And if we go into this time next year, and they hit or they come out flat in the first five half dozen races of the year, I think that the Tifosi will be screaming bloody murder and will be calling for something drastic to be done. So I mean, there is a lot at stake to get it right for next year. But Binotto was even talking about this year's car, the SF21. They feel that a lot of the problems that they had in regards to the straight line speed on the car that they had last year has been fixed. I mean, that was the down on power engine, which we talked about last week, and this so-called or rumored fuel map that they had imposed on them as a penalty for after 2019. But also the aerodynamics were a problem. Binotto had to say, quote, "I think that last year the main issue with was the speed on the straight lines, not only with the power, but also both power and drag. We worked a lot, both on the power unit and the car aerodynamics, to reduce the drag of the car. And based on our simulations today, based on what we can see in terms of power output from the dynos and drag of the car from the wind tunnel, I think we have recovered quite a lot of speed on the straights. So I'm expecting the speed not to be such an issue as it was. We hope it to be competitive, but we'll only know when we're being in Bahrain, because it's always relative to what the others are doing," end quote. And I think that, the key point to be highlighted from that whole quote is exactly what I had in mind when I first saw this article come out, was okay, they may have fixed that straight line speed, but yeah, how does that match up to everyone else? I mean, we saw that McLaren was really competitive last year. They got Mercedes engines now. We saw that Aston Martin and Racing Point last year, they were pretty good. So they've obviously feel that they've improved the SF21, but how does it match up against everyone else? And it will be interesting. I mean, testing's always a little bit different because, they're all doing different things at different time, and even practice is a little bit of never a good indication. So, we're going to have to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt when we get to Bahrain, but certainly it'll be interesting to see what those lap times are going to be.
So the SF21 is actually going to be on the track in 5 days, right? So yeah. I believe the Ferrari is going to take the track Thursday, March 11th in Bahrain. They're going to be able to get, I think, 100 kilometers of testing shakedown ready on that day. Embarrassingly, by the way, as we're talking, a friend just sent me an article, it's almost as if he knew what our topic was about today, but he sent me an article indicating that Ferrari is expected to reveal a two-tone livery for the SF21, and it will be a combination of their traditional red and the darker red that was shown at the Tuscan GP last year.
Oh, here we
so
go.
That red that you like so much may, and again, this is a rumor at this point, may make a reappearance on this car as a part of their permanent livery. So interesting.
That is so disheartening because we haven't even finished recording the show and it's already completely irrelevant.
It's obsolete. But you know, it's better that we can acknowledge it on the air than the listeners hear it. And it's like, what the hell? Where are these guys? So at least we can acknowledge it on the air that maybe this is coming. Again, it's not official. It's not announced. We won't know for a couple of days, but pretty interesting. Yeah, but let's wait for Bahrain. Like, we're going to see this car on the track in 5 days, three by the time most people download this podcast on Monday. But I'm very, very curious to see. And what I'm particularly curious to see is if what we'd reported last week, which was inadvertently reported on a Twitch stream, that they had an artificial restriction last year on their fuel maps, we'll know pretty quickly if they get that back.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it was an interesting slip that Mika Salo made, and who knows whether or not that is actually the truth. But it was a really, really interesting thing to talk about because it really ticked off a lot of boxes when it came to kind of going through all the questions and all the speculation that we had about Ferrari last year. But yeah, it's exciting. Like you say, we're going to see this car in just a couple of days. And, you know, if that rumored kind of transitional livery works or it comes to pass, I think that that will be really great. Who knows? Maybe we'll have to do a revised bracket next week as well, which would be kind of cool. Anyways, I want to talk just quickly now about Mercedes. Lewis feels going into this year that you know, the fact that he's only on a one-year deal is not going to be a big distraction because he said you know, it's not his first rodeo. And I don't think it's going to be a big distraction to him either. I think that Lewis is professional enough. I mean, he's, what, six-time world champion now? Six, seven? I've lost track.
Yeah.
You know, it's so big. But I mean, the point is that I think that Lewis is going to get down and he's going to do what he needs to do each and every race, each and every weekend, every time he straps himself into the car. I think that I know for a fact he's mature enough. He's professional enough. He's able to separate what happens on the track from what off the track. And ultimately that stuff with the contract will or will not get sorted. And I think that whatever the outcome is, I think that whatever happens, I think Lewis will be accepting of that, regardless if he stays with Mercedes for 2022 or not, and he goes on to do something else. You know, I don't feel that he's like a guy that kind of flies by the seat of his pants, that whatever the outcome is ultimately in his best interest.
I think quite differently. You know, I agree with you that this is a guy that knows how to prepare for a Formula One Grand Prix weekend. I think his fitness, I think his nutrition, I think he surrounds himself with great people. Yeah. He's in a very different place emotionally, psychologically, mentally than he was 10 years ago. And I think even he would kind of reflect back and say that, hey, some of those final McLaren years were somewhat problematic. And I think that the transition to Mercedes in 2013 really let him reset his career. Yeah. So I think he's going to continue to show up every weekend. That said, I think it will absolutely be a distraction. And I think it's going to be a distraction because we'll be talking about it. Every other podcast will be talking about it. He's going to be asked about it every single weekend at every single media availability. It's going to come up on the TV shows and it's going to be in print. Like, people are going to be asking those questions and it's going to probably intensify if he's not necessarily in contention for the championship. And I still expect him to be, but I think if he's not in contention for the championship and his contract this year is the weight that we understand it to be, I think it will become a really hot issue. You know, if he's not going to be the champion this year and he's on the open market as a free agent, I don't know what obligations that Mercedes would necessarily have to bring him back. Like, you bring him back right now because you want to give him a hometown deal because he's helped you win six drivers titles at this point. But ultimately, this is also a business focused team, and if they can get somebody in that seat that can do a comparable job for a fraction of the cost, you kind of obligated to do that for your stakeholders and for the board at Mercedes. Again, I'm being far too speculative, but I strongly expect that this is going to be a distraction. And it's going to be a distraction if he's not as competitive as we expect him to be. But I also think if he does run away with the title, it will be potentially equally as distracting because people will be asking the questions like, hey, he's winning the title. This is number eight. Why isn't there an extension? Why aren't we hearing about an extension? Like, he's in a no-win situation. That one-year deal was problematic right from the beginning. I also don't think, and we haven't seen anything to suggest otherwise, but I strongly believe that's not the deal he wanted. I think he wanted a deal with options. I think he wanted a deal with more security. I don't think he's happy with this deal. And I think he went in with a frame of mind client that was a deal that was pre-COVID and that wasn't necessarily available. And whether Mercedes is ever going to admit it or not, I think that that Russell performance in the Sakhir Grand Prix was problematic. And I think he also had no designs on initially returning for Abu Dhabi. And I think his hand was forced because of the performance that Russell put in and the fact that that would erode leverage that he potentially had. So again, a lot of this is speculation, but I think it's going to be problematic. And I think we're going to be talking about it a lot either way.
Yeah, okay. I think you've raised some good points there. So what I think is that he's not going to make it a distraction to himself. The distraction might be, you know, forced upon him because of the media, because of the fans. That makes a complete sense there. And also, I think that whether or not it does or does not work out, I think that perhaps he. I totally agree. I don't think he got the deal that he wanted in this 1 year deal that he got for 2021, and he might not get the deal there. He might not get the deal that he wants for next year. But I think that. Wants and then being, okay to either stay or move on, I think that he's able to maybe draw those lines and then maybe walk away from it. But yeah, it might not be what he wants. I think that would really set the fire off on this thing. I mean, it's going to be percolating and bubbling underneath the surface all season. But say we get to July or something like that, and then all of a sudden they announce that they're going to give Valtteri Bottas a new contract, then that thing is just going to go to a whole new level of speculation and a whole new fever pitch, because George Russell has said that they've made no promises to him for 2022 on a race seat, even though there's potential that either one or both of those seats are open for next year. I mean, the thing is that that opens a lot of questions is that for Bottas, if they give him another deal next year, the one thing is that kind of makes you wonder is, okay, well, what's going to go with the long term, right? Because you can't tell me that if Lewis Hamilton comes back, that you're building long term around 31-year-old, driver number two, Valtteri Bottas, for the best team in Formula One. They might have a transitional period where they kind of look for the next best person or the next best driver to become the new, the new golden child at Mercedes, be the next world champion. I just, I think that there's so many different things in play there. I mean, I still think it'd be a great place for George Russell to go, whether or not we could see kind of that sort of mentorship kind of partnership between him and Lewis Hamilton, who's clearly now on the downslope of his career. I mean, he's mid-30s now. I mean, the end is sort of in sight. I mean, Kimi Raikkonen kind of proves us wrong that, and Fernando Alonso, that there's like a hard age that, you'd have to retire by. But I mean, let's face it, Lewis has more years behind him in Formula One than he has in front of him. So at some point, they're going to have to think about succession and long-term planning. So it really, to me, I think that is going to be the most fascinating thing, is what happens and when do these contracts get addressed? When do they get announced? Do they do it sometime in the middle of the year? Do they announce Bottas as kind of like a pressure tactic for Hamilton or vice versa, or announce that Russell gets that seat for next year and make no announcement on Bottas or Hamilton. I mean, it's fascinating. This is like, I totally agree on one aspect of what you said, is this is something that people are going to be talking about all season long for one, because there's so many different variations on it.
This is the most emotional we've been this whole podcast, and we're talking about speculation, right? I think one thing that we do know is George Russell will not be coming back for a fourth season at Williams. That is not happening. I think it pains him and kills him that he has to get into that car every single weekend while he sees other young drivers like a Max Verstappen and a Gasly, and the past couple of years, drivers like Alex Albon getting these opportunities in massively more capable machinery and winning podiums. Like, I think this is the end of the road for him at Williams. And if Mercedes isn't going to open up a seat for him for 2022, I think Mercedes have to let him go from their program. Like, this will be the end of the road for Williams for sure. Yeah. We just don't know if it's going to be the end of the road for his Mercedes partnership. I don't see Hamilton in a state of mind ultimately where he wants to nurture and take on the role that you and I, or at least I believe that Sebastian Vettel has been asked to undertake at Aston Martin. My sense is that if Lewis Hamilton is in a racing car, it's because he has designs on a championship, mm-hmm. and he won't be in that car otherwise. I don't believe Lewis Hamilton will stay in the sport unless he believes in his heart of hearts that he can win a championship. I believe if he gets to a point where that seat is no longer available, he will leave the sport. He's got way too much going on outside of the sport to remain in an uncompetitive seat. But I also don't believe that he wants to take on the role of nurturing George Russell, who could compete with Hamilton. And again, we have a very small sample, but I think he would be equally as competitive of his Bottas in that seat, if not more so. And I don't think that's good for Hamilton's designs on potentially a ninth championship in 2022. So we'll see. I don't believe that Russell will be back with Williams. Whether he's with Mercedes, I don't know. And if he's not with Mercedes, he won't be part of that family anymore.
Yeah, well, it's come to the point now that they either have to put him into a Mercedes car, or they have to sever those Mercedes ties, or else he's going to end up like Esteban Ocon, who ends up sitting out on a year because there's no seats available.
Right.
And that really tantalizing partnership that you have as a Mercedes driver becomes like a big anchor, and then just handcuffs you, and you can't other opportunities pass you by, and you end up missing a year, which is a big deal. You know, even if you get like a reserve driver role, it's not a race seat. You're not out there doing what you want to do, and it's not an ideal situation. But sticking with Bottas, he said he's really focused on what he called extreme winter training, and really focusing on the mental side. And this kind of really feels like a throwback to the season, the off season between 2018 and 2019. Came in 2019, he won that the Australian Grand Prix. I mean, he really was impressive in that first race. And I mean, I don't want to disrespect Valtteri. I mean, I think he's a good driver. You know, I think he definitely is a good driver to be number two at Mercedes. I mean, he said he wants to be a little bit more selfish in his title bid for 2021. But, I just have real issues with, saying those things in the same sentence, like Valtteri Bottas and title bid, over 23 races. I just can't see how he could, think he could go head to head with Lewis over that length of time, in the same car. I mean, until I'm proven wrong, I just find this one hard to swallow.
Totally. I think we saw peak Bottas at the beginning of the 2019 season, right? Like, we saw that torrid start by Mercedes, and they were swapping wins, and he looked exceptional, and he wasn't making mistakes. And we were seeing a degree of confidence in him on the track, particularly with his racecraft that we hadn't seen before. And I remember every podcast and every media outlet was kind of picking up on that, the notion that, hey, this is V2. He reinvented himself. He's found a new identity. And ultimately, by the middle of that season, it had fizzled away, and we've never seen it again. And he picked up a couple of race wins last year. And to me, I don't know if you can celebrate that. You're in the best car on the track, and in a 17 race calendar, you can't just win two races, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when your teammate wins 10 or 11. I think we've seen the best of Bottas, and I don't think there's anything left for him to find inside him in terms of his psychological approach to the sport. I don't think he has that Nico Rosberg ability to become a dark menace and take that kind of mental warfare into the paddock every single weekend. And if that was there, he needed to apply it from day one, from the first day in 2017. I also think that if he suddenly showed up with kind of a new psychological and mental perspective on how he was going to prepare for the race weekend, I think to the team and Hamilton, this is going to come across as inauthentic and artificial. Like, this isn't who you are. We know this isn't who you are. You've been with us for 4 years. You can't reinvent yourself now. To your point, and the other challenge too is last year, I looked at the mistakes and some of the decision making that he would make on the track, and just like, man, you can't be making those decisions in your early 30s in this car. You're wasting too great of an opportunity. I think he's a great guy, and I think he's the perfect pairing for Hamilton, because he allows Hamilton the freedom to win races and be a champion, but he's also good enough that he guarantees the team constructors every single year. So they're the perfect marriage. I think Mercedes is perfectly happy with him. But I think to your earlier point, ultimately, they're going to have to make a hard decision about what they're going to do with Russell, because Bottas is also not a young driver, right? Like, he's in his 30s. And I think if you don't make that switch next year, you're going to lose Russell. But if you make that switch, you potentially upset Hamilton and change the dynamic of the team. So I think we've seen peak Bottas, and it was the first 2 months of 2019. And I don't think we're going back there.
Yeah, and the other thing is, too, that, you know, going back to that whole Hamilton-Rosberg era, I don't think that Mercedes wants to go back there again. They're in a good place where they've been for the past four seasons. You know, they've won the double championship they've won it ever since 2014, but it's been much less drama-fueled, obviously, since Nico Rosberg retired at the end of 2016 after he won his championship. And I think they're right in that sweet spot right now, and I don't think that they want to upset that. I don't think they want to upset Hamilton. I mean, you know, they make headlines for all the right reasons. They don't want headlines like we saw at Spain in 2016, where they take each other out on the first lap and all the little incident. Oh, Spa, you know, that when they had the coming together and Lewis ended up with the punctured tire and ended up all the way at the back of the grid and all the, you know, the drama. I mean, it was great. If you're not a fan of Mercedes, and it's great if you're outside of the team, because it's fun to watch, and it's great to like all the sound bites. But for the team themselves, it's like the worst case scenario. So. Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I know that Lewis is 35, know that Valtteri is 31, but when you mention it, you know, that they now have two drivers over 30, it kind of really became stark reality that they have to start thinking about, you know, the future now, or else if they wait a year or two, it might be too late. And then, you know, I'm sure if they opened up the money bags, they could pull somebody over. Right. But, you know, there's good options right now that they have. Especially with George Russell. So, you know, finally, just before we go, there's one other article which I thought was really, really good. And Sebastian Vettel was saying that he's at peace now with the, his exit from Ferrari. And of course, this really came up, well, not quite a year ago, but getting pretty quick. It was rather unexpected, because we were all rather waiting for the announcement that he was going to re-sign, get a new deal with Ferrari. But I think that, he's in a good place now at Aston Martin. I think, obviously, the time, you know, became rather dramatic with the Italian Grand Prix at Monza in 2019 when Charles won that race. That, I think there was ever any lingering discussion about who the future for Ferrari was, I think it was settled after the Italian Grand Prix. And last year, it was pretty apparent who they were really focusing on. So I think that Vettel gave it his best. He came awfully close to pulling off in 2018 prior to the summer break, you know, and, you know, there were still some, you know, moments afterwards in the latter half of the season. But I don't think that he has anything to really. Obviously, I think he'll wanted it to turn out different, and I think there's obviously some incidents that he would like to have maybe have played out a little bit different in some races over the past couple of years. But I think on the whole, I think that he shouldn't look down or be negative about his experience at Ferrari. I mean, he gave it the best that he could in a car that was competitive at times, and and more recently not so much. And I think that it's a good place to sort of draw a line in the sand and move forward to the next challenge.
It's a really unique story for Vettel, right? Like you don't see drivers have this type of opportunity this late in their career.
Yeah,
he's been in the sport since 07, 08. He won a race with Alpha. Well, I guess it was Scuderia Toro Rosso before, but ultimately he runs off four championships with Red Bull, makes the transition in 2015 to Ferrari. Obviously, they weren't able to make a significant dent in Mercedes' reign of terror. But ultimately, he gets this unbelievable kind of revival opportunity with this heavily, heavily resourced Aston Martin team. Like, I just think for the narrative of his career, there could be something special here. And ultimately, maybe it's not a driver's title, because I don't know if that's going to happen. But I think if he can go there and he can win races and he can help develop Lance and he can help forge a really strong Aston Martin F1 identity and kind of bring them back into the sport with a significant degree of prominence, like, I think that's going to reflect really well on his career, because ultimately, I don't think the Ferrari period will. And I think that when people reflect back on his successes and his disappointments with Mercedes, they're probably not going to be quick to point out, well, hey, look, it was during an era of absolute massive Mercedes dominance. I think they're going to probably reflect on kind of his personal driver errors, like Singapore in 2018 and some of those mistakes. Like, I think that's what people are going to focus in on. And I think I'm excited for Vettel, because I think he's a great guy, and he's not super charismatic, but I think he's a good guy and he's a good person and he's well-spoken. I think he's great off the track. I think he's a great family guy. I want him to be successful with Aston Martin, and I really hope that this Aston Martin kind of experience helps to transform the narrative of his career. Like, hey, look, he was ultra dominant. He won four titles with Red Bull. He went to Ferrari. He came close, but it was really tough to compete against that dominant Mercedes monster. And then he goes to Aston Martin, and he helps to kind of invent this new kind of reemergence of a works semi pseudo works team at Silverstone. But yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what he can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, perhaps if it hadn't worked out the way it had with Aston Martin, perhaps he went to another team, or perhaps he had to sit out for a year, or perhaps he decided to retire. He may have had a completely different take. But I think certainly going to an exciting team and a team with a lot of prospects over the next couple of years like Aston Martin probably helps soften the blow of, you know, the maybe the disappointments of the what might have been at Ferrari.
Right.
Yeah. And that's it, Mark. That's all I've got. You know, we've covered a lot of ground this week. We made up for, you know, coming in a couple of days late, but I'm glad that we finally got a chance to sit down. And now I guess we're leaving with the ultimate teaser, because we deliberately left out Ferrari out of our bracket. You know, are they going to give us another talking point when we come back on Thursday night to do next week's show? Or are we going to be justified in our bold decision to kind of like glance right over them and push Alfa Romeo through the bracket onto the semifinals? But however it turns out, it's always good, because it's always going to give us something to talk about.
Cool.
All right. Well, that's it, guys. Thank you very much for listening and catching the version of the podcast up on YouTube. If you want to get in touch, by all means, do so. We love the emails, love the tweets that we hear from all of you. And you can do so by sending us email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com or at scuderiaf1pod on the Twitters. And that's it. That's a wrap. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. And let's just think, 2 weeks until the first episode of Drive to Survive, or the entire season, I think, comes out at the same time. And only a couple of weeks to the first race. It's an exciting time of year. It's Christmas Eve for Formula One fans. Doesn't get any better. And with that said, that's a wrap. We're out. Take care. Talk to you guys soon. Bye for now.